This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And good morning, and this is indeed The Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector, as usual, Friday mornings at 9 o'clock, where we offer perspectives, ideas, thoughts, analyses of all manner of questions in the arts and culture and politics, international economics, and occasionally in literature, even once in a while on opera. We've done that too, as you know. Today's guest is Patrick Bond. Patrick Bond has a distinguished academic resume. After half of his titles, it always seems to say distinguished professor of sociology or aeronautics or whatever it might be. I know it's a title, but it also indicates a certain degree of respect. He's currently at the University of Johannesburg. He describes himself as a political economist, a political ecologist, and a scholar of social mobilization. And over the years in South Africa, he's taught at the University of the Western Cape, WITS, the University of KwaZulu-Natal. And interestingly, he's been a visiting professor at Gyeongsang National University in South Korea. North Korea doesn't have visiting professors, to the best of my knowledge. And at the University of Manchester. And among other, there are a number of other universities. The list is very long. His doctorate's in economic geography from a modest academic institution by the name of Johns Hopkins University, which is one of America's great universities. And he went to the Wharton School of Finance at the University of Pennsylvania. Footnote here. That's Donald Trump's alumnus from my institution, too.
And Elon Musk. Don't forget our Joburg homeboy who learned some naughty habits at Wharton, too. Yeah, terrible place.
I'm reading his bio right now, as a matter of fact, the one that just came out yesterday. And I hadn't gotten as far as his sojourn to University of Pennsylvania, but that's coming soon. He went to Swarthmore, which is another fine, lesser-known school in South Africa, I think, but one of America's great smaller institutions of higher learning. And then most fascinatingly, he's had a semester of classical guitar tuition at the Peabody Conservatory in Baltimore. Why?
Well, very good to be with you, Brooks. And that's a great question to start with, because as a Pennsylvania native yourself, you know how, say, incestuous that scene can be. So I needed a break away from my undergrad. And so I went for some classical guitar training. I've been playing since a little child and never made anything of it, because you have to be very, very good. And I was pretty mediocre, actually.
I'm really pleased when someone decides that the idea behind education is education, and the word university implies there's a universe of knowledge and all things are possible. That's to be applauded. I was never talented enough in music to consider it, although I one semester I took all of my courses with the same code number in front of them just to see what would happen. And then in another semester I designed a pattern of classes that were two intersecting diamonds, and we just found classes to fit those times. And both cases, the synergies were fascinating. I learned more that year than I probably did any other time because of the unexpected. But what we wanted to talk about today, rather than to reminisce about behavior in college, is a topic that we've covered it recently with Professor Yaki Sillier, the Institute for Security Studies, during the actual event. But BRICS, the economic formulation or forum or whatever we actually want to call that thing, it's still on the minds of many. And in fact, since it finished its meeting, it got larger, became more inclusive with additional members. But as I read things that you have written on BRICS, although you and Yaki have distinctly different approaches to the understanding of the forum, I gather that you have a sense of an overblown rhetorical importance for BRICS as well, and you don't see a whole lot of positives there. Am I reading you correctly in this?
Yes, that's correct, Brooks, and I'm sure we'll find some interesting ideological differences. My bias is from the left, the independent left, not the left of the Communist Party or EFF or ANC, Radical Economic Transformation, or NUMSA. Those are Metal Workers Union, the biggest union. Those four major groups have come out very much in favor of BRICS, in favor of Russian invasion of Ukraine, in favor of coal instead of renewable energy. So I find myself with the independent left tradition, which I learned really doing anti-apartheid solidarity charity work in the 1980s in Philadelphia and Baltimore. I find myself with a group of scholars, but also activists who came out to protest in Sandton on the 23rd of August, representing a variety of causes. But we certainly, I think we all stand much more for values of humanity, of the environment, a sane geopolitics. So that's going to be the bias I bring. And I think Jackie and maybe yourself would have a different perspective, but it's great to compare notes.
Well, I mean, my bias, and I'll state it frankly, is that I think it, the significance of the organization, if you want to call it an organization, has been dramatically overstated and its influence is rather less than meets the eye. And I end up ultimately thinking in terms of other institutions internationally that probably have more actual impact, as well as the, you know, the old and traditional idea that international relations still depends to a considerable degree on state interactions, as well as all of the other groups, whether they're unions or international NGOs or formations of like-minded individuals, as well as economic institutions and business institutions. But I don't see, what I don't see in BRICS is a core. It sort of, it somehow reminds me of the old Winston Churchill joke when at the end of his dinner and they bring his pudding, he says to the waiter, "Waiter, remove this pudding. There's no theme."
Beautiful. Well, the theme, of course, is that the BRIC countries without South Africa during the early 2000s were booming. And by 2001, they were already evidently going to be leaders of the 21st century. Hence, Jim O'Neill, the Goldman Sachs investment banker, said, oh, there's a BRIC formation that should be encouraged to be part and parcel of Western capitalism, Brazil, Russia, India, China. So they started meeting in Ekaterinburg, Russia in 2007. And by 2010, in the Delhi meeting, the Chinese, Wen Jiabao, the leader, had said, let's bring in an African country, and South Africa was most obvious. So the theme was to have a presence in the major continents of the emerging powers, and then to promise, and I say promise advisedly, all sorts of benefits, like an internet network. We've just lost our cables, as you probably saw off the West Coast, and so we desperately need a backup internet, even if it goes through Russia and China, where the internet censorship is worse than Elon Musk's Twitter. Then you've got also the hope for a vaccine center from 2018 when we hosted. We desperately need a vaccine center, don't we? We found that out in 2020. And when Sputnik from Russia, when the Sinovac and Sinopharm came up from China, well, unfortunately didn't have a vaccine center. We don't have a BRICS internet. We thought we would have an alternative finance here. Brooks, you probably remember a contingent reserve arrangement, CRA, was announced in 2014 in a Brazilian summit, Fortaleza. And that never came to be. And hence, South Africa has gone to the IMF in August 2020 to get a $4.3 billion loan. I could go on. We were supposed to have a credit rating agency, so we don't turn to Standard & Poor's, Fitch & Moody's all the time with all of their biases and incompetencies. And we never got that. So yeah, let's say lots of promises, but the only real institution that's been delivered, not satisfactorily by any means, is the BRICS New Development Bank. It's now run by the former Brazilian president, Dilma Rousseff, but lots of rhetoric, but not much in the way of delivery. We can talk about the details.
I mean, I'm glad you actually mentioned the New Development Bank, because it came about at a time when capital available for borrowing, whether it was from multilateral institutions or venture capitalists or those wicked Wall Street types or government institutions, was at historic low rates in interest terms, and the money was desperately looking for places to invest. And the amount of capital that was assembled for the BRICS Bank was a mere fraction of what might have been available on any given day from any of the other institutions. I was always puzzled by the idea that somehow magically South Africa would invest in this to the tune of X billion dollars. Notice they're still using dollars for this, and then be able to borrow it back basically for things. And then with the footnote that if the lending was politically determined, then the bank was opening itself up all the time to questions of improper lending at best, or much worse, simply because it was making available money for political purposes rather than on on real economic terms. I might also add that of the new members to BRICS or BRICS Plus or whatever they're going to end up calling it, Argentina may well be the single most dependent on the IMF and the World Bank for capital because it's been in a perpetual state of turmoil or chaos for pretty much as long as I can remember, always borrowing money to refinance the previous money that they borrowed that they managed to use up in ways that nobody could quite determine.
Oh, yes. So, yeah, Argentina is definitely the basket case. And you're right, under the thumb of the IMF. So President Lula, Brazil, wanted to get his center-left friends in Argentina into the BRICS as a sort of reward. But then, as you probably saw, there's a far-right resurgence, a Bolsonaro type of character from Argentina, who just won the plurality of votes in the primary election. He may win in October, maybe win a runoff in November, and we might see a Bolsonaro-Trump type of figure in Argentina. That would be very ironic, wouldn't it, as the BRICS opened the doors in January to Argentina.
Well, I mean, that leads me to the idea that actually two comments. One, that of the countries that were in already or being brought in, if you worry at all about worker rights and human rights and civil liberties, the list of Russia, China, Ethiopia, Saudi Arabia, and Iran is not exactly a heartwarming idea. But also
UAE and China, of course, too. Yeah, they just hosted the G20 last week in India and just were ravaging poor people. They were just tossing them off the streets, getting them out of the way in the most brutal way. You know what the Indian government also does to Muslims, to Kashmiris, to the Dalits, to the lower caste. So, yeah, we are talking about a trade union of dictators, let's say. The BRICS Plus.
This is a deep dive. I'm Brooke Spector, and it's a delight to be talking with Patrick Bond, who has an academic resume that was longer than the document I could print on my computer. And we're talking about all manner of BRICS and other international and world economic issues. And we'll be right back.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And this is the Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector, and we, of course, are continuing our conversation with Professor Patrick Bond, who is now temporarily in Britain and then on to Berlin, and then shortly to return to South Africa, where he is now ensconced at the University of Johannesburg. We were talking about the human rights record, old and new BRICS members, human rights in the broader aspect, I think, rather than just necessarily individual civil rights, communal and group rights as well. But one thing that does puzzle me, and when you describe the intent President Lula for encouraging Argentina to be included in BRICS, why not Mexico? Mexico is a much more robust economy. It has a left-leaning president, and we'll probably have another one in the current upcoming election. But then behind that, there were countries like Indonesia, which is a massive economy and which sits as one of the founder members, in fact, of the non-aligned movement. Then there's Nigeria, Malaysia, Thailand, Turkey, Morocco. All of those countries seem to me in some ways to have been better candidates than the collection of countries they ended up with.
Yes, I agree. And the criteria for choosing was totally opaque. And when Anil Suklal, our Durko Sherpa, as they call him, a Sherpa, a sort of backroom deal maker for South Africa to join the other four Sherpas, and they came up with these six, it didn't make much sense. Before we go into some of them and whether this is a new power block, not only of the tyrannies, as you say, but also very carbon-addicted countries, four of them, Saudi Arabia, UAE, Egypt and Iran having extreme dependence on oil and gas, whether that's going to affect the next big United Nations climate summit is of great concern. That's going to be hosted by UAE in Dubai in December. And of course, as a footnote, the question of the Guptas being friends of the UAE elites and not being extradited as we requested reminds us of the complications. But the other point you made just before the break about the New Development Bank, I just want to touch on because we were expecting a few things from the New Development Bank. I mean, one is, as you say, they not only enumerate their shareholding in dollars, but they also are lending 88% in dollars and euros and yen. So they've got an addiction to hard currency. And Lula's choice to replace the right-wing president of the New Development Bank Dilma Rousseff, a former president, who came from a Marxist guerrilla group and then became much more orthodox in her ways. And I spent a week with her in 2019 and got to know her a little bit. And you know, I definitely found somebody, even though she's close to Vladimir Putin, but who looks to the West. And so she said, we will only move to 30% dollar, non-dollar denominations, local currencies. And that's mostly the yuan, a little bit in the rand. They did issue a rand bond recently. So the whole idea that there would be a de-dollarization, which was being promoted heavily by a variety of people. Brooks, you probably saw these left anti-imperialists who think the BRICS are going to, you know, somehow challenge the West. I disagree with them. We also have people who support gold as a currency, the gold bugs. We also have the cyber currency characters. And they were all pushing, if you watched YouTube or saw any of the commentary, very, very hard, the idea that the BRICS would de-dollarize because of, especially Vladimir Putin, under financial sanctions. And that financial sanctions hit them hard when Janet Yellen, the U.S. Finance Minister, said, we will chop them out of SWIFT, the interbank system for payments, and also seize assets, about $650 billion, as I recall, of both central bank and the oligarch assets. So that was the incentive, wasn't it, to have you know, kind of Russia to push de-dollarization. It didn't happen. And I think it's telling that when we're talking about the new development bank, it's not really any different than the World Bank. When I look at the loans in great detail, I think I've probably looked at them more closely than anyone. And they're very corrupt loans. Every single one of the dozen loans that the BRICS Bank has made here, I would say carries with it the stain of corruption. But also that the BRICS Bank is part of the financial sanctions against Russia. So even though Russia is an 18% shareholder, as we are as well, they get hit with financial sanctions by the BRICS Bank on March 4, 2022. And the reason was that the BRICS Bank looks to New York credit rating agencies to get a high credit rating so that their borrowing costs in international markets are a little bit lower. They get AA. Even that was downgraded last July when Putin defaulted on his foreign debt. So I would say that there's a real hypocritical, let me call it talk left, walk right, or a real sense, Brooks, that the anti-imperialist rhetoric suits, especially someone like Dilma, when she says we need to de-dollarize. But the hard reality is what I would term sub-imperialists. They're very much within, not against the Western system. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, it does in considerable ways. I was going to mention de-dollarization was actually my next talking point for our conversation. Problem I've had with the de-dollarization rhetoric is that it somehow has implied in most hands that these poor beleaguered nations are forced against their will to use dollars for everything, when in fact people go to dollars, countries, businesses, individuals, for a couple of obvious and simple reasons. One, it's reasonably stable, it's secure, it hasn't defaulted on its debt, and...
Well, don't speak too quickly on that one, Brooks. They nearly did a few weeks ago, and they may well do again in October. So, yeah, that's a very good question.
That was going to be one of my footnotes that, if there was anything that will drive the direction toward that, it's the shenanigans... of Congress in fiddling with the national accounts right up the lip of the crater, to mix metaphors unmercifully. Institutions, individuals, countries use the dollar as a handhold because it's easier. I mean, after all, if you don't have a reserve currency somehow, somewhere, you are effectively back to, I will give you five pairs of shoes in exchange for two barrels of oil and a basket of wheat. And who's going to figure out what those exchange rates are?
India and Russia had learned that to their regret when the rupees are piling up in the Russian bank accounts within India, because Russia sold so much cheap energy during this kind of crisis. The Russians and Indians, you know, particularly Putin and Modi, made this deal. But the trade imbalance is exactly the problem that you're hinting at, that we don't really know how to clear when you don't have a third currency that's accepted by everyone. And especially with Indian exchange controls, which I think are laudable, the rupees are sitting there in accounts and the Russian energy companies can't get them out.
Well, that, of course, that allows us to sort of segue slightly to the fate of the seriously bedraggled ruble.
Before
right
we
now.
Do that, could Could you concede that the U.S. dollar might be, in your framing, I think, Brooks, you'd say, a global public good? It's out there as a store of value. It's a reputable currency that, you know, all the people of the world have their Benjamins, their $100 bills tucked away somewhere, especially as criminals. That's the main currency of choice. But would you concede, and I happen to work in the Federal Reserve under Paul Volcker, and the damage that the Fed can do, the Federal Reserve handles the value of the dollar, and prints money. It's now called quantitative easing. They like obscure terms, but it means they're running the printing presses. And in addition, they can tighten. And that affects the entire world. Since early 2022, our own interest rates with our own Reserve Bank Governor, Liseko Kanyako, a sort of mini-me to Jerome Powell, the current Fed chair. It means that we're in a real zigzag. And when you add to that, that the Fed, certainly when I worked under Volcker, it wasn't so bad, but they're really financial deregulatory plus bailout specialists, right? And even when Janet Yellen was the leader, there was still a big problem with bailing out their mates. And we saw that already this year with three of the four biggest U.S. bankruptcies, and they all get bailed out. So I would say, Brooks, that the U.S. dollar has been mismanaged. It's not a Federal Reserve that I could recognize as being genuinely interested in financial stability. It's interested in bailouts and financial deregulation. And regrettably, because the dollar is so dominant in world trade, in finance, and in foreign direct investment calculations, we are dealing with a hegemonic role that I think even someone like Jim O'Neill will agree shouldn't be as it is, that we shouldn't be so reliant on the dollar. Would you not concede the logic to that critique?
We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back. We're speaking with Patrick Bond of the University of Johannesburg and many other places, and as well as a guitar student. I still love that a great deal. This is Brooks Spector, The Deep Dive. We'll be right back.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooks Spector.
And this is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooks Spector, and my guest this morning is Patrick Bond, professor at the University of Johannesburg. And we're dissecting the influence, the impact, the importance, the future of the BRICS formulation, or the BRICS plus one. I'm glad you mentioned Jim O'Neill, because he is, as you note correctly, the intellectual father of this thing in the first place. And he did it as a way of, it was back when he was at Goldman Sachs and a sovereign debt bond salesman, basically. And he said, this is a great way to package the bonds of China, Russia, Brazil and India to my clients who want to have a hand in the emerging markets world and get big returns for a little bit of risk, buy those bonds. And as I read some things he had written, he weighed a lot of other countries might well have been part of that, but the acronym was what won the day. And so I've ended up writing about BRICS without straw, with a sort of a biblical allusion thrown in there.
Or sprawling BRICS. I mean, because the construction listeners know that BRICS, if you're building a wall badly, well, the wall will collapse and, you know, the mortar will fall out, and the so-called spalling of the BRICS seemed evident. The BRICS, as O'Neill put it, building BRICS of the 21st century, the foundation for a world economy that would be driven by a new set of more dynamic economies with this variety, let's say, of respective strengths. But of course, it's just been China and India that have powered ahead, whereas especially the 2014 crash of commodities that affected South Africa also affected Russia with the energy price collapse that year, and Brazil with not just energy but soy. Now those, let's say, whims of world commodity markets, driven in the early 2010s by Chinese expansion. So they went way up and we had a commodity super cycle. They've also gone very far up in price since, 2021, after the COVID recovery began, after COVID, and then peaked around April, May of last year. And now our own tax revenues are way down because the mineral prices are also way down in virtually every category. So yeah, we are subject to a degree of, let's say, the world economy being whimsical. And the idea of the BRICS was to try to rationalize it and get more fairness and justice in trade. That's the rhetoric. As well as, by the way, BRICS, attempts to reform the world, the multilateral system. So one of the things in this financial reform agenda, not just starting new institutions, was to make the IMF and the World Bank, right, the two big Washington institutions, respond to the needs of the emerging markets. And I follow that very closely. And you probably know that the first Indian was elected to run the World Bank by the Biden administration, his name, Ajay Banga. But he really is better known as MasterCard's president and a big corporate guy. So he's an American citizen. And before that, Jim Yong Kim was Barack Obama's choice, a Korean-born but still very Americanized man. In between, David Malpass, who was a Sinophobe and climate denialist. Before that, Robert Zoellick. Before that, Paul Wolfowitz, who came from the State Department. Now, these are guys that the U.S. appoints as the president of the World Bank. And there were better candidates like Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, who Pravin Gordhan supported to be the president in 2012 instead of Jim Yong Kim, who was simply Dartmouth College president.
She ended up with another position that is...
She became head of the WTO, but it was seen as this terrible injustice. Do you remember? And the same with the IMF. You remember when Dominique Strauss-Kahn, the French finance minister, was accused of raping a West African woman in a hotel? He had to resign. And Christine Lagarde, who was French finance minister, came in, and she was under prosecution already at that time for bribery associated with Adidas, and she was eventually found guilty of that as the head of the IMF. And then Kristalina Georgieva replaced her. Now, in all of these cases, Brooks, you'd agree, it just is bizarre that the IMF is run by a European, the World Bank by an American, and even the likes of your Trevor Manuels, who are well-respected, couldn't get in. There was, you know, he was nominated effectively once or twice, you know, in the sort of opinion polls. But these are the sorts of leadership problems. And I happened to be last month in China, and I was with Justin Lin, who was World Bank chief economist. And I raised that and the de-dollarization. I said, aren't you in China still, you know, not concerned that the new World Bank president is still an American appointee? Who, by the way, last week in India, joined with Joe Biden, Cyril Ramaphosa, Lula da Silva, and who was the fourth? And Narendra Modi himself, to say we are the G20 hosts. That is India this year, Brazil next year, South Africa in 2 years, and the U.S. in 3 years' time. And we are going to push very hard on new bigger, better development banks. So I found that very compelling that this is still a sort of silver bullet, isn't it? That this was really the only statement that these guys made. Now, the point being that the attempt to reform the IMF and World Bank included lots of new money invested in 2015. There was a big recapitalization. The IMF got lots more money. China, India, Brazil, and even Russia went up respectively 35%, 23%, 11%, and 8%. South Africa lost 21% because we didn't have enough money to put into the IMF then, and we lost. And Nigeria and Venezuela lost 41%.
I'm going to interrupt you for just a second and give you my own view on this litany of destruction that you've outlined. Over the years, I've met any number of World Bank and IMF specialists, not the top leadership. I only met two of the heads in any meaningful way over 30-some years. But I've dealt with lots of the individual officials within the two institutions, the ones who actually shape and make the proposals and deal with the pitches and then sign off on the actual loans or in other instruments. And I've always been something of an institutionalist on my view of the two organizations, because although the man or woman sitting at the very top says things and gives speeches and has a really nice suite of offices and gets first class air travel and lots of other goodies, it's the people 2-3 layers down who actually make the decisions and who shape the institution's lending or participation much more directly and much more deeply than the lofty statements by the man who says we're going to focus more on human needs or dams or bridges or climate or whatever it might be at the flavor of the month at either of those two or the World Trade Organization for that matter, because they're so big and they're so impactful that it really is hard to find one individual who turns that ship in an entirely different way, except in the gauziest kind of version of things. But that's,
yes,
that's
my view. I think you're right. I mean, Joe Stiglitz, right, who won the Nobel Prize in 2001, he was fired earlier that year for trying exactly, as you say, to turn this ship around. He had the term post-Washington consent to try to get away from the 1990s orthodoxy, the structural adjustment, the friction in that. It's impossible, I think, to overcome. If you think of the worst they ever made, probably the biggest, as I said, Dupi coal-fired power plant coal-fired power plant for ESCOM at $3.75 billion, done in April 2010. And there was a big coalition of civil society and even some governments, even the U.S., Norway voted against, but Robert Zoellick, the then president, pushed it through. And as we know, it was, and they knew it at the time, the whole country knew, because we had some 2007, 2008 disclosures. That was a corrupt institution, Hitachi, and the African National Congress Chancellor House, that was a sort of bought into the subsidiary, 25%. So those are the sorts of deals that shouldn't happen, but they keep happening, including in the BRICS Bank. And I've documented that at some length, that the, just let's say, degree to which, as we see with a G20 meeting that I mentioned, where Modi, Biden, Lula, Ramaphosa, and the new bank president, Ajay Banga, came together, a bigger, better new development bank system, I doubt it.
Let's turn our attention briefly to the upcoming meeting. Well, that's not fair to say. It happened already. I got lost there on the calendar. The just recently concluded G20 meeting and its inclusion for next year of the African Union as a permanent member, in the same way, presumably, as the European Union is a permanent member. So it'll be the G21 or something, or whatever we want to call it. It too is an institution that doesn't have a permanent home, doesn't have a secretary, it doesn't have an organizational institutional culture, doesn't actually implementing mechanisms. I compare it, for example, to the EU, NATO, the OECD, the Organization of
Economic Cooperation and Development.
Economic Cooperation and Development. I'm getting old. I mean, I get the acronym and forget the name. And a few other organizations like that. And the G20++ is more in line with things like ASEAN and the African Union and, the Arab League or whatever they're calling that now these days, in that they don't actually do anything. They have lovely meetings.
Yes, so you're right. And the one just concluded was a way for Narendra Modi to again sort of take South leadership. The fact that Xi Jinping didn't come, also reflecting the border tensions and the other internecine battles, the Sino-Indian conflict is a very serious one, but also Vladimir Putin didn't come. These do reflect that the G20 is something that the BRICS core of China and Russia are moving away from. It will be held in Brazil, so that may change the balance of forces, because Lula is very ambitious and has more credibility, I think, than Modi on all sorts of levels. The fact that the AU comes is more a legitimation exercise for the G20 than anything particularly useful. The last time, I think, probably agree, the G20 was really brought into action, not just a sort of nominal set of meetings, was in 2008. Do you remember? I think it was in, was it in Pittsburgh? They made, that was 2009. They met three times. They met in Washington in October 2008. They met in London in May 2009, and then in Pittsburgh later that year. And in these meetings, the big challenge was to print more money, right? To open up the IMF quite a bit more and to give it $1 trillion worth of new lending. Trevor Manuel coordinated that effort. And so the G20 had that role where the G7, or at that time it was called the G8 because Russia was still a member, couldn't do the lifting of the global financial system to bail it out, to print money, to quantitative ease at the level needed. And the two big owners of U.S. Treasury bills, China and Saudi Arabia, had to come into the table. Now we've got the BRICS Plus, which includes Argentina, a G20 member, and Saudi Arabia. And as you say, there will be more. Mexico is quite likely to brought in, if not in the next round, the round after that. And the G20 may be just surpassed by the new BRICS. And this is what Joe Biden went to India to try to prevent. And this is why that meeting that was held with Biden, Ramaphosa, Lula, and Modi, plus Ajay Banga from the World Bank, I think was revealing. It was an attempt to say, no, the G20 is still under decent Western control with these strong southern allies, India, Brazil, South Africa, still look to the West. I think there was a lot more symbolism in that, and maybe some reality as well.
I mean, my own feeling is that a lot of these meetings, if they have not yet reached their sell-by date, they are rapidly getting there, virtually because the ability to meet electronically is now so much better than it was during that 2008-2009 financial crisis. And the security and other organizational requirements are now so onerous. They shut down a city when they do this. The travel arrangements become extraordinary. The number of people dedicated to these things becomes massive, not just the host country, but all the participating countries. They bring hordes of people to work on the committees and the meetings and the this and the that and the security, that it's going, that there will be simpler ways to do this, to deal with more complicated problems than simply an event to have a photo, what we call derisively the class photo with the funny shirts.
Correct. And the dilemma is that we desperately need global leadership. We have seen multilateral processes, institutions completely unable, whether it's the WHO on the pandemic or WTO on increasing global trade, which, as you know, is actually in a stagnant period. Trade to GDP hasn't risen since 2008. It's been falling. In fact, we have a deglobalization, or we have the IMF and World Bank unable to deal with the development finance requirements for a just transition to a post-carbon society and economy. So in these ways, plus geopolitics, plus any number of what the World Economic Forum calls the polycrisis, the overlapping, interlocking problems that the multilateral system now cannot solve and the world elites cannot solve, you kind of expect the G20 to make major statements like debt cancellation and more availability of finance for climate catastrophe, especially if we've just seen that hit Africa so hard in Libya, but also Mozambique or our own city of Durban. And we desperately need cheaper development finance. In fact, I would say grant finance as the West confronts the need to pay its climate debt. And the G20 is the place to do that, but they did nothing, nothing at all worth comment in the meeting just concluded. And the next big meeting will be coming up in the UAE, the Dubai hosting of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change in December. And I think we can expect the same absolute failure of the world elites to deal with these extraordinary problems.
Well, I mean, there were two things that the G20 communique, the final communique, all 37 pages of it. And I confess, I finally did not finish reading it in one go. I fell asleep several times. And it's a thick document to read, even though it's fairly brief for thick documents. They could not manage to come up with anything more than saying it really is a bad thing when countries invade other countries and it shouldn't ought to be done.
Pathetic, isn't it? Yeah. Sergei Lavrov came away smiling. It was really tragic to see the Russians kind of maneuver behind the scenes to get that sort of concession on the language.
I mean, Joe Biden put the best face on it that you possibly could, saying effectively that it was an emphatic statement against non-interference and intervention in other countries. But it didn't get to the heart of what is plaguing Europe now, or the world at large, if you happen to be someone in the Middle East or Africa who depends on imported food through the Black Sea and energy and fertilizer. And it also didn't come up with a distinct, specific, concrete set of steps on, as you have said repeatedly, climate issues. It was in favor of preventing terrible things.
Yeah, just a phase down of coal, not the phase out we need, and not any other mention of other fossil fuels. Yeah, it was pathetic. And it just shows that global elites, Brooke, something maybe we agree on, are just not up to the job of the polycrisis. And we have to clear them out, get a new set. And that's why, Brooks, the bricks from below idea and the protesters that were out on, you know, in a bit of a sporadic way, put 4 kilometers away in the, in a park,
in a street park
in something. Yeah. But the point being that, all of a sudden, out of nowhere come major, surprises in February of 2011. The Mubarak regime was tossed out of Egypt by Tahrir Square protesters in the Arab Spring. It's that sort of spirit that we see come up again and again that gives me some hope that even if we have a BRICS plus, it looks like it's a block of tyrannical, carbon-addicted economies that are not against but within the world capitalist system, we might have enough resistance from all sorts of forces of labor and women in Iran and, you know, environmentalists and youth and communities that give me at least continuing hope that even the big power structures can be shaken.
You sound more and more like a left-leaning version of Robert Kaplan in the coming anarchy than I had expected today.
Well, in the Marxist framing, as I adhere to, there is an internal contradiction of capitalism. It turns out that China is, ironically, the Communist Party-led China is the source of that contradiction, which is overproduction. And as they try to displace it, as they move their excesses through the Belt and Road Initiative, their term is going out, I'm finding so much interesting resistance. I spent a few days wandering around Zimbabwe with the Center for Natural Resource Governance and seeing all of the different ways people are protesting the looting of Zimbabwe's minerals by Chinese companies. That's just one of many ways, I think, in the period ahead, Brooks, our social forces that are interested in environment and social justice and geopolitical sanity, I hope can come together. And even though, as I said at the outset, four big groups of the center-left, the ANC, Radical Economic Transformation, EFF, Communist Party, and the biggest union, the metal workers, they're all pro-BRICS, and they're pro-Putin, and they're pro-coal. I don't think that really does represent the best traditions in this country.
We're going to take a quick break one more time. This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooks Spector, and we're chatting with Patrick Bond, professor at the University of Johannesburg, and with a wide range of interest, ideas, thoughts, and concerns. And we'll be right back.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooks Spector.
And this is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooks Spector, and my guest today is Professor Patrick Bond of the University of Johannesburg, although we're talking with him in Britain. By the miracle of electronic communication, it's almost as if he's down the street, which is quite nice. And we have been chatting about the use, disuse, misuse, ill use of BRICS or BRICS Plus and what that may possibly imply for the future, as well as, and we broadened this out a little bit toward the G20, its place and permanence in the world, and whether or not there are other things that may come along, other mechanisms, other means by which this blue marble in the sky can be held together appropriately and happily. If you could sort of pull together your thoughts over this last hour, if you look forward over the next couple of years, what are the likely occurrences that you see happening? Not the things you hope, but the things that you think are actually going to occur.
Well, I would like to end with one or two sources of enormous hope that I have. But before that, you're right. Dilemmas of geopolitical conflagration actually becoming a nuclear Armageddon, the dilemmas of the climate catastrophe hitting, not just this is a big storm, Daniel, that started in Greece, devastating, and then just killed 15,000 people in northern Libya. The expansion of our, let's say, debt bubbles, the financial bubbles that were bursting so badly even this year that the U.S. had to deal with huge bankruptcies and the second biggest bank in Switzerland, Credit Suisse, went under. These are at least three of the terrains in geopolitics, in environment, and in finance that I see continuing to worsen because I think we've agreed the G20, currently the premier site of sort of planning solutions, or the World Economic Forum, the corporate side, or the multilateral institutions, the interstate sites, they're just not up to the job. So I would be quite pessimistic when it comes to elites, but I would want to end with an optimistic idea as well. And that idea, Brooks, is that the forces of popular, democratic, progressive thinking can move from an analysis of a problem to solutions out of nowhere. So if we were thinking about these problems, say, 40 years ago in the early 80s, P.W. Botha had just put together a tricameral parliament where he tried to co-opt Indian and colored people into the parliament through the House of Delegates. House of Representatives and through Bantustans, one led by Gachibutlesi, although not a full formal state, but KwaZulu, and black local authorities running places like Soweto. And the left critique was that these are just illegitimate co-optation devices, as Archbishop Tutu said, that this is polishing the chains of apartheid. We need to break them. And something came out in August 1983, a United Democratic Front that did sweep. And I know as somebody who you were watching that very closely from your own perch, probably you were surprised as we activists were in the U.S. side in the student movement and so delighted that this movement could undermine apartheid and then lead to a financial crash. A second, if we were talking 20 years ago, we would have said probably the biggest problem South Africa faced was AIDS, with about 6 million out of 50 million people at the time being positive. And the cost of AIDS medicines, you remember, well over 100,000 rand a year. Only a very small fraction of those who are HIV positive could get medicines. And those were branded medicines from U.S. pharmaceutical companies. And so to go to the World Trade Organization in November 2001 and say, we want the generic version. We want intellectual property waiver so that we can get these medicines for free through the state. Seemed impossible, especially since we had an AIDS denialist president, Thabo Mbeki, at the time. But within 3 years, indeed, the ANC rulers had overturned President Mbeki's policy. And over time, from 2005, the rollout really began in earnest so that we did get AIDS medicines to currently 7 million HIV-positive South Africans. And the life expectancy went from, at that point in 2005, 52, and it's now 65. So these are two miracles in the case of the United Democratic Front and the Liberation Forces in the early 80s, or in the case of the Treatment Action Campaign in the early 2000s. They sort of come out of nowhere, and they can make enormous change and achieve formidable progress. So I just hope we'll be able to say the same thing about climate, about geopolitics, about economics, so that justice prevails instead of the current system, which elites are just mismanaging as badly as I can imagine.
I would just add that the HIV and AIDS issue was dealt with dramatically to the unparalleled and most expansive foreign aid program, the PEPFAR. Badly acronymed PEPFAR program.
You're actually right. And so the fact that that's under threat as we speak from the Republican Party in the U.S. Indeed. House of Representatives, it's just shocking because it has saved millions of lives. And I should add that PEPFAR started out as a way that Jesse Helms, a U.S. Senator, conservative, wanted to save pharmaceutical company profits. But he was won over, and generics were pushed by a group called Health Gap. And so PEPFAR became not a U.S. pharmaceutical agency, but actually quite a good agency. And there's a global fund to fight TB, AIDS, and malaria that the UN ran. Another great example of grant-based, not lending, in a way that I hope our climate negotiators can also take inspiration from. Because bottom line is the North really, and the West, now the BRICS Plus, they've taken so much out of poor people, whether in South Africa or all over Africa. And it really is time we insist that they give back. And we have these models like PEPFAR and the UN Fund to Fight TB, AIDS, and Malaria. We have the defeat of apartheid by people of goodwill all over the world who've promoted sanctions and supported democracy. So we can look to the future, not with pessimism and defeatism, but some wonderful memories that South Africans have been at the very cutting edge for progress.
We're going to leave it there, not to finish forever, but at least for this time, because our allotted time has finally reached its end. We've been chatting with Patrick Bond, professor at the University of Johannesburg, and with a wide range of eclectic interests, from international financial institutions to the classic guitar. And we have been talking about BRICS, BRICS Plus, the G20, the failures of the present and the possibilities of the future. It's been a delight to have you. I thank you very much for sharing your time with us.
Wonderful to be with you, Brooks. Shalom. Thanks again.